You can listen at KEXC.org or on your smart speaker. We need people like you to support this local media. We are people-powered radio. You can text the word donate right now to 218-326-1234.
You're listening to Ham Radio on KAXE,
Cooking with Amy Thielen.
I remember everything, every song you sang to me, making coffee every morning. Doesn't matter where I go, another day, another show. No.
This show is all about recipes, specifically how we use them, how we relate to them. Like, do you find recipes reassuring, or do you find them just a little bit annoying? Do you cook by the book, or do you like to just scan it and then go off script? Heidi, how do you use recipes? I don't know. I've never heard you talk about that.
Well, we're new friends, right? And we haven't known each other forever, and that's kind of an intimate question, Amy.
Oh, it's too personal.
No, I think I can trust you, right? It ends up being about time for me.
Yeah.
And so I'm not great at recipes. It's like I scan a little too much. I do whatever I feel like half the time. But recently, honestly, Ham Radio has inspired me. I was at a friend's house and she had a new cookbook that was Vietnamese, like rice bowl. And she said the recipes were easy. I bought the cookbook. I followed it exactly. And it was great.
It was good.
Yeah. And so I've learned I've got to do this more. I just have to pay attention a little bit more. And on especially something I haven't made before. I think I always sort of wondered, like, well, this recipe must not work, when I really wasn't paying attention to if I actually did put everything in there they said to.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's just so many recipes right now. You know, there's blog stuff. There are books. Like, I want to give a shout out for books, because
yes,
that's me. That, you know, those recipes and books are really, and magazines too, they're heavily tested and vetted. But then, you know, your great grandma's something that people have been making for a long time can be just as great and reliable. So it's kind of a weird question. I think it has to do sometimes, I'm starting to think it has to do a little bit with our, like, where we are in time.
Oh.
Like, you know, my grandma's time, a recipe that was given to her by a neighbor was more reliable or more respected than maybe something she would read in the paper.
Right.
And I don't know why that is necessarily, but
there's all different. I mean, I think people get used to different things. I think I've told you the story before, but I ended up finding a box of recipes of my mom's. She and I had gone through it, you know, about 6 months before she passed away. And we'd put them in this box. It was an old Schwann's box. So that's sort of lovely, too. It's this cardboard thing. But inside of it are the recipes from the Star Tribune that she and my grandma would mail back and forth to each other.
Mm-hmm.
And some of them, I could remember her cooking them. And then some were aspirational. And it is so fun. Like, it sort of surprises me how fun it is for me to look at these cutout newspaper recipes in this cardboard box.
Yeah.
It just says so much about
There's so much
them.
About her personality in that recipe box. Yeah, my mom had a recipe box. My grandma had a recipe box, too. And that's like, you know, what were their cookbooks? Mostly the recipe box.
Yeah, I mean, she had cookbooks, too, but I think it just depended, you know, what they were feeling.
Right. Well, you know, for me, it's just, I mean, my relationship is obviously kind of fraught and interesting, I guess, because I write recipes.
Yeah.
So that feels like work. I write and test. That's working. I'm on the clock, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Even though sometimes we eat the stuff at night, you know, we eat it afterward. But then when I'm cooking for fun, which I also do on the weekends and things like that, then I don't want to follow anything. I just want to freeform it.
So I have a question for you. So you're kind of, when you're on the clock and you're writing a recipe as you're cooking, so you're kind of cooking and writing down what you're doing.
Yeah, I'm recording what I'm doing.
Gotcha.
Mm-hmm. So, and hopefully I write the title of it on the top, because I have pages and pages and pages of things that I don't know what actually they were.
So my question to you is, so, and then often you'll feed your family with that, but you'll taste it first, right? To see if it's what you wanted.
Sure.
Yeah. And can you tell, like, immediately, like, oh, that was way too much celery, or that was not enough salt, or can
oh,
you
yeah.
tell? Okay.
I mean, to hit the right amount of salt, sometimes you have to overshoot it.
Yeah.
And then you scale it back. So then you, and I always kind of go a little bit on the low end of salt,
okay,
because just to, you know, people's preference.
And then how much does your family's response to this new recipe matter to you?
If I'm being truthful, it doesn't matter.
They're not listening, right? They just need food at that point. They're not there to judge. Okay. This is interesting. We'll have to keep talking about stuff like this, how long it takes to put together a cookbook. And we have really interesting guests tonight that are going to talk more about these recipes and how you put them together and how we use them. And do you follow them? It's interesting.
But I think it's kind of like it's a, you know, it makes, sometimes recipes, I feel like they can make people feel bad or they can make people feel really good. And I think it has to do with whether you enjoy, like a friend of mine who calls, she's got a supper club or a dinner club or a cookbook club, you know, and she calls a lot and she is looking, she likes to follow a recipe that's going to be really specific and just really come through for her. And I think, and there are certain recipe writers, like, even before I went to cooking school, I would read these recipes by Paula Wolfert or Madeline Kamen. And I mean, they're kind of a generate, you know, the recipes are so well written. They can teach you a lot. Like, uh-huh, I learned a lot from reading these recipes.
Huh. We have Carla listening in from Minneapolis, and she said, this is a perfect show for me. I just cook. I don't use a recipe. So uh-huh, it's interesting to hear about this kind of stuff. I also had a conversation with Kari on the morning show this week on KEXE. And we were talking about if we used internet recipes and that what a pain it is if you're like cooking from your phone or something. And then she said one of the things that she hates the most about the internet recipes is the scrolling to go back up. You might read the text of it, what you do, but then you don't remember how much something. How many cups?
Sure.
And she's like, why don't they put that right in the text of it also? Couldn't they do that? I think that's a internet problem. I don't think that's a problem for
I don't
your
know.
Eyes
I just,
in a book.
I don't know about internet recipes. It's you know, they come up for me too. I'm just thinking about like my grandma and like when she had a noodle dough recipe, it was easily memorizable. Okay? So I even know her noodle dough. Here's her noodle dough. It's one cup of flour. Now I don't remember it, right? Okay. One cup of flour, one egg, and half an eggshell of water. That's what it is.
What?
Yeah.
Half an eggshell of water.
Yeah. So you mix together an egg with half an eggshell of water, whisk that, and then you combine that in the flour and of course a little bit of salt, and then you knead. And those are those kinds of like, it's like kind of a German noodle for like chicken noodle soup or something.
Mm-hmm.
It works.
Mm. That's great.
Yeah.
I love that. Would you ever put that in one of your recipes?
I think I did.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I like it.
Yeah.
We're going to be listening to lots of conversations this evening. We're also, towards the end of the show, we'll take your phone calls and your texts, but you can text right now to 218-326-1234. As we're speaking, someone's making last week's recipe, onion pie from Park Rapids. And the house is smelling great. So, good to hear.
Awesome. So, we're going to be talking to Natasha Pickowitz. She is a chef, a baker, cookbook author, and a friend. She's the author of More Than Cake, an excellent cookbook all about baking, and the upcoming Everyone Hot Pot. And that's about the Chinese tradition of hot pot, a celebratory, communal, center-of-the-table one-pot meal. It's so fun to talk to Natasha. I just want to know what you think of like this maybe very bold assertion that baking is maybe more precise and scientific and that savory cooking is a little bit looser and, you know, more freeform or improvisational. But then what complicates that, I think, is that your stuff is so inventive and more than cake and all the making the cakes. What struck me is like you've made making cakes really creative and improvisational and freeform itself. So I guess I just want to ask you about baking and what do you think about that idea that it's a little bit more precise? Maybe I'm wrong.
Great. Love it. No, this is definitely like I have strong opinions about this stuff because I think baking is just so much more beholden to these stressors that people have when they are starting to cook or bake that savory side isn't always subject to. And it's in our heads and it's not real. But, you know, I think there is always like a seed or kernel of truth to those worries that people do have. But, you know, the whole reason why I wrote the book was to reassure people through my tone and through like the instruction that it didn't have to be an anxious thing. And here's how to sort of like go about doing that. Knowledge is power. So I tend to be on the side of over explaining, I think, when it comes to recipe writing, but I don't want to leave anything out. If there's a question that's raised, I want to feel like I'm implicitly answering it in the instruction. Like I'm anticipating people's needs and like their concerns and what might come up for them.
Right. Exactly. More Than Cake is, you know, I love this book. It makes it look really fun because it can be a little bit intimidating to make a cake that is celebratory. And the cake is, if nothing else is done for the party, at least there's this giant cake, you know?
Yeah.
Like it's such a generous impulse to make a cake for somebody.
I mean, I really, really appreciate you saying that. Cookbook writing, but also teaching other people how to bake in my restaurant career and everything else is how can we reframe these ideas, these stigmas, these fears that we have around certain things and think about them in a different way that can cause us to feel more relaxed, feel more confident, have more fun. And, you know, I think a perfect example is sort of the collective, not to generalize, the collective American reluctance to engage with a digital scale when they're baking. Like Americans have this incredible attachment to the notoriously fickle and imprecise volume measurement system. And
you don't sound upset about that at all.
For me, it was really important in the book to not shame someone for that way of thinking or to chastise them or, you know, embarrass them being like, this is the way to do things. This is the best way. But instead, I wanted to reframe it in these terms of what if we thought about using a scale as a way to make baking faster, more reliable, more fun, more speedy. And I think I like compare it in the book Front Matter to, you know, it's like, you've been wearing uncomfortable shoes all day and suddenly you put on a great pair of running sneakers and you're like hitting the pavement and suddenly you're like flying.
Yes.
A lot of the book deals with this idea of setting yourself up for success mentally, but also materially. And once you sort of are putting these things in place to set yourself up, the actual act of baking can be fun, meditative, silly, improvisatory, you know, et cetera. It can be all of those things. But I think like with any skill or any craft or any discipline, it requires like a understanding of the practice before you begin. And that's where you can kind of go fun and go off script a bit. But you do need to do that work in advance to sort of get to that place.
Wow. Yeah. This is, so I'm having this like visceral flashback to working in kitchens and I was on the savory side most of the time where things were crazy, people running around. And then you walk into the pastry kitchen and the pastry kitchen is also crazy and busy, very busy, especially in a big restaurant where you're handling like a whole bunch of stuff. But it's like, these are like the sane people in the restaurant, you know, it's like,
totally.
You know, that's exactly what you're talking about. It's like, set yourself up for success because then you can play and fly. And that's another thing I think about. It's always like people don't always have big enough cutting boards or big enough bowls or struggle with like wrong size stuff. And the thing is, once you have those things, like you're saying, the scale, then it's just really comfortable. And then you're putting music on, you're cooking in slippers. It's easier to do the grams. It's just an easier, I agree with you.
Tear. You don't have to clean out those stupid little stacking cups. You don't have to like tilt your head to see if like the flour's level in your cup. Like I can't. And the thing is like, maybe if you were just making like brownies or something at home, like a flexible recipe that's in a pan, that's what you're used to. Like, awesome, you do you. But I'm definitely coming at this from the perspective of working in a large scale production bakery / restaurant or cafe where, you know, you really can't eyeball 17 cups of flour and you don't want to, because that's where recipes can get really wacky. The way Jack makes it is going to be very different from how Jill makes it the next day. So grams is how restaurants can ensure consistency in their execution of recipes. And
yes,
I think that really resonates with home bakers too, where you want to be consistent so that the scone you make one day is going to be the thing that hits the spot the next year when you open your cookbook. And anything I can do to take out that question mark, that ambiguity, that what did I mess up here? Because it is natural to introduce human error into cooking, because, you know, the way I fold something might not be as strong as the way you fold something. And I want to allow for that. But using a scale, this is one X factor we can take out. And now we're all on the same page as far as numbers are concerned.
As you're talking, I'm thinking, oh, this is exactly why Natasha's recipes work so well. Because you are thinking all the way around. What are the possibilities? Where are the pitfalls? Let's dodge them. And it is exciting, though, to see scales are more popular than they used to be. And
yeah,
if you scale something the same time, you know, you get used to it and you kind of memorize it. Let's say the bread that I make once a week, which is honestly not remarkable, but it's good. It's like a real wet, moist, high ratio of water dough. And I it's not sourdough. It's just sit on the counter all day.
Love it.
But once you have that memorized, it is so quick to put together.
Exactly. This is like a larger comment I just have about society today and expectations around things, is that I think that with things like social media and hacks and shortcuts and TikTok and which is all great, I think people really forget that in order to become good at a craft, and actually like baking is the same way, it's something where you can develop a fluency around it. And once that you kind of lock in that skill, you're making that loaf of bread every week, you start to develop muscle memory around that. And
yes,
it become as big of a deal to drag out the bowls and to find the flour. You're already there, you know? And I think, so when people see my recipes and maybe they think, oh, that's advanced, it's complicated, it's challenging, I'm like, well, like so many things in life, it's something that gets easier and better and more fun the more that you do it. But I was also very aware of wanting to have recipes that a beginner could jump into and not feel overwhelmed. So I really worked to try to present like a range of techniques and, you know, more entry level to kind of more tricky things.
Oh, I love this conversation with Natasha about, you know, the sweet side and the savory side, the pastry kitchen and the savory chef, how they're differently wired. It's really true. I mean, she's just making a case for really following recipes and in the name of like time saving and also stress reducing, which I sometimes think about it and I'm like, oh, that's going to be a little technical. But she's saying, you know, it's really going to, that muscle memory, you're going to develop this fluency, it's going to get easier. And I know what she's talking about. I think it's brilliant. That's really true.
I think I've been fully convinced that I need to get a scale and not use those measuring cups anymore, because when I bake, I am doing it pretty fast, so I'm probably not doing it exactly right. So I wonder, why didn't it turn out like the last time? Well, there's a lot of reasons, probably.
Well, the reason for the scale is really because sometimes when that flour sits in the store, if it's been there a long time, it settles. And so like a cup of flour will weigh something, you know, like 4.5 ounces. And then the next time you go, the flour is looser or something, and then it weighs 5 ounces. So you can't get that consistency unless you're weighing it. And I don't think it matters whether it's ounces or it's grams, you know, professional kitchens use grams, but you know, you can buy these like those little electric scales.
Okay.
I mean, they come, the only thing is that they require those kind of annoying coin-sized batteries, you know?
Oh, yes. I know what you're saying. Why are those so annoying? But they are, but yes. But okay, I think it's worth it because mm-hmm. I wonder about these things too. Like if I'm investing some time in baking something and I have baked it, I'm using a recipe I've used many times.
Yeah.
But doesn't quite turn out.
Well, sometimes it's even like just a different brand of flour.
Yeah.
It's crazy.
Learning a lot. So we go from baking into savory now with Natasha Pickowitz as we talk about kind of the difference in recipes there, right?
Yeah, because now she's doing a book about hot pot. And yeah, this is really interesting too. How is it to move from like the sweet side to the savory side of the kitchen? Or am I making too big a deal out of that? How does that feel?
I have so many questions for you about this because I think that because I've been baking for so long, especially in a professional context, I came into writing that first book with a repertoire, with a decade of worth of ideas, and with my approach to developing recipes was very deliberate and methodical. And not to be too glib or whatever, but I kind of felt like developing the savory recipes is more like vibe focused. They were less technique up front and more, what are the flavors and textures and ideas that I want to pull into these recipes? And then I would kind of figure out the technique to get me there. The most important thing is that the recipe worked, would ensure success for the reader. Whereas I feel like with the savory recipes, I felt a little bit more pressure to have ideas that perhaps even the title of the recipe would stand out to the reader. Like mm-hmm. that there had to be something in the idea of the recipe that would grab someone and not so much about like the technique of it. So it was hard for me to write in a totally different way because often I'm not following recipes when I'm cooking at home for myself. I'm tasting as I go. I'm evaluating the quality of the product. I'm playing around with knife cuts. I'm adjusting seasoning. I'm making it fit with everything else on the menu. And so writing the recipes for this book has been more like, how do I summarize that attitude that I was taking when I was doing that kind of cooking? Trickier in a different way because, and I think that's where I got in the weeds a bit with variations and substitutions and swaps because I'm like, oh, if you don't have jicama, use this. And if you don't have lotus root, try that. And mm-hmm. it kind of is endless. And so I wanted to be like, how can I stick with the concise idea? But I also wanted to present something tight and like focused. So yes. I think finding that balance was kind of tricky.
This is so interesting to me. The savory recipes, sometimes they just never end. You just have to call it. Because the other thing is that a lot of times when you're developing and then testing stuff that you would eat for dinner, let's say, you're making it for dinner. This is what I do anyway.
Right.
I don't just like test all day and throw it away or give it away. You know, I incorporate it into my life so much so that my family gets sick of stuff, right? But yes, ingredients then, they will vary and it does change. And so I find that I kind of idealize these like old fashioned short recipes where it's just super evocative and the method was super short and you just got mm-hmm. it or you didn't or whatever. But in reality, it's like all of that information is going in the method.
That's actually almost exactly how I think about it too. It's tricky. I mean, even something for like, so if we're talking hot pot, well, like writing a recipe for broth, for example, wow. I have a methodology and like a value system around making broth. Like I know I want something sweet in there, like a carrot, like alliums, seasoning it. I like fresh herbs, but I like dried herbs. I like, do I want spices? Am I browning the bones before I'm adding the water? I know what I'm going to do, but for something like broth, it's very much a end result of like what I have available, what I feel like, kind of vibey, you know, I'm just... Mm-hmm. putting things in and letting it go because something like broth is so forgiving. Yeah, it does feel a little bit more intuitive in that way. But I wanted to write recipes that had parameters and guidelines to them. So it was really interesting to be like, I like making broth at a very bare simmer over 6 hours or even overnight. And I like to do all these grandma things that I think really improve the flavor and the clarity and whatever. But in the process of writing it out, I'm like, is this realistic? Are people going to work it this way? Going back to this point of people want shortcuts. They want broth in 30 minutes. And I'm like, well, some things you can't rush. And actually, if you love the process of something bubbling away on your stove or the smell of celery and water, actually, like, I love it. Like, there's nothing I love more than something bubbling away on my stovetop.
I love that you picked celery and water.
Well, you know what I'm talking about.
I do. I love the smell of celery and water. It's very specific. It's kind of... It's lovely.
True. It's intoxicating. I want to breathe that. I want to be in that perfume. And I wanted to worry less about what people expect or hope from me and just focus more on being as honest as possible with the way that I do things and hope that it resonates with people. I mean, who knows? Already I feel like I'm in a super challenging market because nobody knows me in Savory Side. It's a single subject book about a cuisine that some people might not know about. It does feel like I'm doing something a bit risky, but at the same time, it feels like the most natural thing in the world that this is what my book is about.
Natasha, this book is going to be hot. You know, I'm sorry, but it is.
Literally. Yeah.
It is. And you had a lot of savory stuff in your first book, actually.
That's true. And also like working quite a lot with fresh perishable ingredients like produce and fruits and vegetables and stuff like that. So I was trying to bring in that culinary savory side expertise. My trick, if you buy like melon because you just need to have it in March or whatever, what we did in the restaurants is we'd season it with vinegar. We would add things to perk it up. And like there's a way you can
salt,
season fruit like you would season vegetables in a salad. So
I also share with you that's a divide. But maybe it's more of a divide like in professional kitchens than it is for a lot of people because they're just making soup and then they're baking a cake. This kind of gets back to like there is a little bit of a different brain space. I'm fascinated by this conversation. Can you just tell us something?
Yeah.
Like, tell me about Hot Pot.
I mean, the book, it's essentially a way of entertaining. Basically, my mom immigrated from China in the early 80s. My dad is a Chinese historian. So growing up, like we were, you know, eating Chinese food at home every night on the weekends or for major holidays or having their friends over. Their dinner party was always hot pot. Hot pot is this way of eating that is deeply communal and interactive because you are all gathered around a pot of bubbling liquid, water, broth, whatever.
You've made during the day, making the broth,
exactly,
with the grandma style tricks.
Exactly. So I have so many. I learned my parents' way of doing hot pot, which is this act of cooking a la minute, tiny bite-sized food in bubbling broth. You're essentially poaching a little slip of meat, a little cube of tofu, a little sprig of green. You're cooking that a la minute in a matter of seconds. It's going right from the pot into your little dipping sauce bowl. And from there, it goes right into your mouth. So nobody's handing you a plate of food. There's no cooking to do in advance, hardly any. And so my thesis is this is a great way of having people over, especially if you're someone that feels nervous about cooking. Because guess what? All you have to do is go to the grocery store, buy killer ingredients, wash them, put them out on the table, and everyone goes nuts. There's something really disarming and really beautiful about people jockeying for bites at the table. You're bumping elbows, you're making a mess, you're laughing, you're having fun. There's just something incredibly disarming and convivial about it.
Almost like a design thing, or it's an expression of your home and who you are, is how you assemble this. And I can see these double page photos already of these tables.
So good. They're incredible. But also, like, I think another thing that I really wanted to emphasize was that Hot Pot also really like embodies this incredible range of experiences. You know, it can be this really frugal meal that, you know, students have. You can really have an incredible experience where the sum is greater than the parts. Or on the other end of the continuum, it can really embody this like sumptuous experience, and you might have raw oysters on the table, and Hot Pot can bend to all of those needs. You know, people are just so hungry, figuratively, for these opportunities to come together at home, want to put this in front of people and say, like, I don't know, I think this could be your new favorite thing, you know?
You whisper it. This could be your new favorite
thing. Yeah.
Oh, the potpourri of celery and water. That kills me. I love so much because that scent of celery and water feels like Thanksgiving, and it is really delicious. It's really lovely.
I didn't realize that. I was just thought of celery as really not tasting like much for some reason up until like a few years ago. And then I started realizing how much I liked it.
Yeah.
You know? And honestly, it was because someone told me they hate it. And I was like, what? How could you hate it? It doesn't taste like anything. And then all of a sudden I started realizing I love it.
Maybe, you know, we just take celery for granted.
See?
Because it's in the winter, though, it's something you can buy.
Yes,
you know,
that's
it's
true.
Reliable.
And I love the what is it called? Celery hearts? The inside stuff with
too.
The little leaves?
Yeah, the yellow parts. It's like parsley.
So nice.
I love all these grandma things. She said I was doing grandma things to my broth, right? Mm-hmm. And I think what she means is like, or what she meant was like, you know, things you can't necessarily describe in teaspoons or cups or something like that, but it's more of a technique. It's something, a feeling, like it's description, that kind of stuff. That part of a recipe comes out in writing the method and describing to people, like, what's it going to look like? What will it smell like? What will the bubbles look like? That kind of thing.
Because it is, sure, it's a recipe. It's a kind of prescription for something to cook in a cookbook, but you are telling stories, and people do just read a cookbook because it is telling a story in there, especially people like you and Tasha, where the books are really about something else too.
Really? Yes. I mean, the story is so much often a big part of it. And, you know, our next guest has been telling me a story recipe, let's say a narrative recipe. He told it to me 15 years ago. This is Nick Torres. He is a food stylist, a food photographer, a recipe developer. He was based in LA, but he went to college in Minnesota, which is how I met him, because he was my intern for my first cookbook, The New Midwestern Table. So it was during this time that Nick told me this story, this recipe story for beer cooler chicken. So Nick, this week we're talking about recipes, and I thought of you immediately because one of the most vivid story recipes that are narrative, that's in my memory, is one you told me when we were working on my first cookbook so many years ago, and you were on the food styling team, and you would tell me about this beer cooler chicken that your mom's family used to make when you guys went to the cottage in Ohio on the shores of Lake Erie. Tell me that story again. I just want to hear it.
So yeah, it's a local classic. I think it is based from North Baltimore, and it's not to be confused with beer can chicken, which I feel like is much more popularized.
Right. This is so much more epic though. Yeah.
Yes, it's a real experience. So, I mean, just first, it is just the most moist, delicious chicken. And I think without the recipe, you wouldn't be able to figure out how they made it. So it's usually for large crowds. And the real kicker is this basting liquid that they use. So you grill chicken halves.
And they're halves, okay.
Yes.
Are they seasoned with anything first?
Some sort of kind of grill poultry seasoning. Chewy, the person who taught me this recipe, who also goes by his government name, which is Dave McEwen, he says his favorite was Earth Poultry Seasonings, which was actually like a local company that is now defunct. But he's basically said any grill poultry seasoning, so probably just like salt, pepper, garlic, onion type of vibe.
Sure.
So they season the chicken halves, and then they have these massive fire pits that he says holds like 125 chicken halves.
Huge.
Yes.
Permanent pits or what?
Yes. I think they have it at kind of like community festival grounds. Basically, they've built these fire pits. So he usually makes 250 halves. Mm-hmm. And he says that will fill, it ends up in a cooler, So it fills two large 120 quart coolers.
Whoa. So those are like the two handled coolers, takes like two people to move around.
Exactly. And probably just don't move them after you put the chicken in. Yes.
Okay. So you grill the chicken, and like how far does he grill it?
He said almost all the way, like three quarter. Like, so you grill it hot. And then as you grill it, you spritz it with a mixture of 1/3 each red wine vinegar, white wine vinegar, Worcester, and then if you like it, a touch of liquid smoke.
Beautiful. That's the love right there, is that spritz.
Mm-hmm.
Keeping it moist.
And so as you cook the chicken, you're spritzing it with this mixture. And then you line these large coolers with foil, probably to help keep the heat in, but also just like sanitation. I don't know. Unclear. And then as you layer the chicken, you spritz it and it goes like chicken foil until it's all the way full. But the whole thing is like super saturated with this liquid.
And then what? And then people just sit on the coolers, have a beer and wait for dinner time or what?
So they'll do this early. And then he said ideally like 3 hours, but you can literally leave it in there because it'll stay hot. And yeah, prep for the party and definitely drink beers. Absolutely.
And so then you uncork it from the coolers and it's just like fall apart.
Yes, just like fall off the bone, juicy, delicious.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it's such a brilliant technique. It's the same thing that people do when, like, for brisket, you know, like like barbecued, like Texas brisket, where I've tried to do this, you know, and then after you hit a certain temperature and it's tender, then you also like you wrap it and let it sit and rest for a really long time. And the juices just kind of get reabsorb. Sucked back in.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So I've never forgotten that. Have you made this yourself? Have you ever made like a small version of that at home?
My brother and I tried to make a version of this when I still lived in Columbus. And I feel like it's not enough. It's hard to make it for six people. Like you actually need to be doing 120 chicken halves. I don't know. Whatever feels, your cooler needs to be large enough. Because I feel like if you do a smaller version, it's not enough chicken, not enough heat.
Yeah. So you need like actually that mass of like the big coolers. Like you couldn't just like split them out into like 20 of those little coolers. It wouldn't be the same thing because it would lose heat.
Exactly. Yes.
Oh yeah. That's so brilliant. I mean, we're talking about recipes and how we follow them. And I'm thinking about old recipes in cookbooks. And this is reminding me of like when I was doing research about old Midwestern food, I would come across these story recipes like this that would be in cookbooks and they would just be prose, basically. You know, it's not quantity. It's like how it's done, you know? So how do we translate that into, like, are we losing things? You're a recipe developer, you're a, you know, food stylist, food photographer. Are we losing certain things that we can't translate easily?
I would say probably, honestly, especially in today's world with the internet, there's so many recipes. And I feel like the more recipes we have, the less people are able to kind of just like cook through, you know, just like their feeling, the vibe, like just like actually kind of understand how we got there. And like most of the good recipes, or most of the people that I've learned how to cook from, they don't use recipes. They're kind of just like handed down.
Mm-hmm.
They hung out with them, you know, 100 times while they made this chicken.
I love that. Yeah. So what are you cooking lately? Like what's going on? Nick Toro's world.
I have to admit the last 2 weeks I've been obsessed with chicken salad and tuna salad.
Mm-hmm. Really?
Yes.
Has summer hit. Yeah.
Yeah. I think why? Summer hit. I don't have AC.
You remember that summer at my house? I still don't have AC.
That's crazy. Not even like a floor option for the bedroom.
Well, okay. Yeah. We got some window ones, but you know, it's Northern Minnesota. It's so rare that we need it.
Yes. But when it's hot, it is hot and it's steamy.
So chicken salad, tuna salad.
Yeah. And I guess in other things, I mean, I'm always obsessed with chicken wings, which are also great for entertaining, which I think it's controversial. I have always and continue to do a naked fry.
What's that?
Like don't salt, don't season, don't do anything really. You just fry it hard and then all of it relies on your sauce.
Oh, the chicken. It's just like reliant on the chicken.
Mm-hmm.
And then you like toss it in stuff that sticks to it or what?
Yep. I have a few sauces are my go-to. I love a red curry buffalo with like fish sauce, honey, red curry paste, obviously, buffalo sauce.
Ooh, pass that one on.
But yeah, I feel like I go in seasons. I go in stages with cooking. And generally, I never have a plan. It's just like, I just like to cook with what's on hand. Just feel it out.
See here, this is the trend. Like all these people who work in recipes and they get home, they don't want to have anything to do with them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's very funny because, yeah, I do get paid to write many, many recipes, but I rarely, unless it's like baking. Baking is really the only time that I might utilize a recipe. And one of the main baking recipes that is a go-to for mine is your cardamom sticky buns from the cookbook that we worked on.
Yeah, I haven't made those probably since then.
They're so good, honestly. You should try them again.
But yeah, baking can be like really precise and scientific and like what's your comfort zone? Do you like doing that? You like kind of getting nerding out and like getting into like weighing things by the gram or where you
are? That is definitely not. I'm like, I feel like I'm an ADHD recipe tester. Even when I'm like commissioned to write recipes, I usually write them in my head. Like I have a recipe written. I write it as if it's a complete recipe and then I'll try it and then make tweaks as I cook.
So like when you're writing the methods and stuff, what's your philosophy about that?
You mean like when you get really detailed, like when you're explaining to somebody like how to make like a lattice pie crust in written word? That's like my least favorite because you're trying to like, you know, you're just like rotate it 30 degrees and slice it. Like I feel like to save my sanity, I usually try to simplify it as much as possible. And if I ever did my own cookbook, I feel like it would rely on photos. Like some things it's just like, by the time you write how to do a lattice pie crust, it's a paragraph.
No, it is. And then you think about like those old cookbooks, they were so brief.
I actually love those.
You do? Why do you like those?
I think because it's so simple, I could see how someone would hate it if they didn't know how to cook. But like if you give the ingredient list and you're just like butter, sugar, mix, you know, it's just like you don't need to explain like the size of bowl, the type of utensil, how you should move your hands. You know, I feel like sometimes it like overcomplicates it.
Right. Well, and then your medium is so visual. Like, how do you explain things visually? Do you find yourself when you're photographing work or styling it, kind of like telling the story of how it's made, or what's your approach to that?
My strength in food styling and in photography, I think I like a lived in feel. It's more about like the vibe, the energy of where is this? Whose party is this? Who's eating this? As opposed to just like a perfect slice of cherry pie, which I think has its place. And some people are really good at that. And I feel like, you know, they're more type A, but I feel like I lean to a little more messy, realistic energy for sure.
No, I love your style. Yeah. It's got a lot of information. Like there's a narrative. There's like a story going on.
And people gravitate towards that. Like it's not perfect, but you kind of get an idea of who this is, where it's from. Like if I did beer cooler chicken as a photo,
yeah,
we would have to be in Ohio. There's just like no question about it. We'd have to get these guys. There would be New Balance shoes with grass stains on them. Like there would be like a Budweiser can in the background. There would be like a Chihuahua somewhere, you know?
You need to make that happen. I want to see that shot, Nick.
Yes, I'm really hoping that this interview gives Dave McEwen / Chewy's Beer Cooler Chicken his flowers. Someone call him, someone reach out.
Yeah, he sounds amazing. He sounds like a career chef.
Absolutely. He would love to hear that.
Yeah, we should make a ham radio t-shirt with his name on the back. Chewy.
Please do. Beer Cooler Chicken hats. It's your new merch.
It's all right, but you know how I like it. It's just fine, but you know how I like it. Ooh la la la, ooh le le le. If I'm honest, it's just okay.
Oh my.
I love it.
Yes.
I think Nick is right. We need to see a photo to really understand what this recipe is.
I know.
I mean, that said, so this is going to be the community recipe of the week.
Okay.
And we'll post it on Monday.
Okay. But it needs to be, as far as you guys were saying, that big quantities of this chicken.
Yeah. So I looked it up, 120 quart coolers. Those kind of like the standard, very extra large.
Okay.
Coleman with the, you know, the two handles.
Yeah.
That, you know, like you said, don't move it once the chicken's in it. So if we could just get it down maybe by a quarter to like one large cooler, I don't know. I might have to try that. I'm gonna try this summer.
You should.
Yeah.
That'll be our recipe of the week. It'll be available Monday. We actually are hearing from folks who are trying last week's recipe, sending us a beautiful photo that I think even Nick would love as a food photographer of the beautiful onion pie in a cast iron skillet with some white wine.
Yeah, it's beautiful. That was great.
That was last week's. Thanks so much for joining in. You can text us at 218-326-1234. You can call us. Our phone lines are open and we would love to hear from you. We did get this call that came in earlier.
I remember being out at Heidi's one night and eating some really good salmon chowder that she made, you know, and asking her, hey, can I get the recipe from you? Or how'd you make this? And, you know, Heidi wasn't able to tell me, which I think is the other reason I like to follow recipes so you can replicate what you've made. I also don't have time to screw things up. It's not worth it for me to make a meal that falls flat. I might risk or lose out on some new wonderful combination, but I play it safe.
Oh, I love that.
So that's why I didn't realize why she was so insane about needing the recipe and was basically mad at me that I couldn't give her the salmon chowder recipe.
Heidi, you should be writing that down as you make it.
Nope, that one's in my head. I've done it so many times and made little changes and it always works.
Yeah, that sounds really good. Mm-hmm. Salmon chowder with corn, cream.
A part of it is the ingredients. We've been talking about this too, right? Mm-hmm. My brother's a salmon fisherman, a guy.
Right.
So I have good salmon. So
right.
It makes all the difference in the world right there.
Oh, I didn't really understand that you have so much good salmon. Okay.
I mean,
what can I trade you?
Well, there's lots of things. Oh my gosh. A dinner at Amy Thielen, stuff like that. Hey, Amy, we were talking about celery earlier and your love of the smell of celery, and Justine's listening in, also known as Princess Citronella.
That's
her handle.
Love it.
And
what does she say?
She says there's a reason celery is called an aromatic.
Well, that's a very good point.
Good point. We do have a call coming in now.
Hi, you're on Ham Radio.
Hello, Amy. This is Rachel from Park Rapids. How are you?
Hi, Rachel. How are you?
I'm good. So I just wanted to call in and say that I also don't like to follow recipes.
Okay.
It's not really how my brain works. So I get kind of stuck when, like, I try and follow them too precisely. It doesn't work very well for me. Unless I'm baking, which I'm not very good at. If I'm baking, I try and follow the recipe really exactly. But I made the onion pie this afternoon, and I got stuck because I was trying to follow it too perfectly. And then I realized halfway through, like, I was slicing the onions and putting them in the pan and not measuring. And I was like, you know what? It's going to be fine. And it was. It's delicious.
Yay.
We've been eating it with a glass of wine while we listen to you.
Oh, sweet. So tell me, like, when you're following a recipe, if the recipe, is it like recipes that get too long or involved that you're kind of like, oh, I'm out?
It's not even too long and involved. It's when I see them, I feel like I need to do it perfectly. And so,
interesting.
But if I can just like get inspired by it, then I can do my own thing a little bit. Like, I know what they're going for, and I can do my own thing. and I think the trick might be, for me anyways, because I've been cooking long enough that I'm confident in what I'm doing.
Yes.
So, like, my husband is a fantastic cook, but he's a perfectionist. So he's a really great baker. But when he's cooking, like, it's taken him a long time to feel comfortable enough to, like, branch outside of the recipe a little bit. But for me, I feel like just the inspiration from the recipe is my favorite part. And the beautiful stories, like in your cookbook, the beautiful stories and the writing and the photos, that actually inspires me more than the actual details of the recipe.
All right. That's like another vote for the photos and the stories. I understand completely, though, that you don't, if you're in, we're talking about in relationship to the recipe, and you don't want to feel like you... This is not a place or a time for you to feel bad about anything because you're making dinner, you know?
right.
So I say go off script. I mean, I'm the same way when I'm not working. I just take inspiration as well. So thank you for calling, Rachel.
Yeah.
We do have another caller coming in.
Hi, you're on Ham Radio. Hey, you're on
Ham
Radio.
Is Ted.
Hi. Who's this?
It's Ted.
Ted. Hi, Ted Lee.
Ted. Ted Lee.
Yay. How are you? You're listening from Brooklyn?
Yes, I'm listening from Brooklyn, and this is, I love this show. It's so in my wheelhouse. The whole idea of how do you write a recipe that people will follow, but then understand that people don't necessarily want to follow a recipe.
I know, there's that dichotomy. I thought of you too, because you and I have these conversations. So, yeah. Well, I mean, what do you think about like Rachel's comment about how she doesn't want to feel guilty, I guess, or do it wrong?
Yeah, nobody should feel guilty. I mean, that's the thing about kitchens are such personal places, right? And everyone's practice is so unique to them. And so it's totally natural that someone would want to sort of take a recipe and make it their own. And my question to you, Amy, is I wonder if you've ever had someone make your recipe and then tell you they took it to a different place, like it inspired them to do something that was kind of different. Because I've had that happen in my own experience, and it's kind of awesome, you know?
Yeah.
Like when someone said, I had a chef in...
Like, what did they do for you?
Ashley Christensen.
Yeah.
She said, oh, you know, I loved your buttermilk pudding cake recipe, but I took it to a different place. She said, we stretched it with buttermilk, and now we use it in the restaurant as our pancake recipe.
That's crazy. That's awesome. I mean, she would know. She's a genius, too. And you have great recipes. You know, it's, yeah, it's like maybe they're, you
but
can't really hold recipes
you?
In, you know what I mean? Like, they're kind of like a springboard, really, for people to add things. Like, when people, yeah, a lot of times people will write to me and say, oh, I made a substitution and now, and then another substitution, another one. Now it's like completely different. But, you know, even that they take the time to write is great, because I don't care if people take a recipe and slap their own name on it and start making it and never credit me. I mean, it doesn't matter to me.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? I mean, I feel like that was kind of the old days.
Yeah, right. Sometimes, you know, their ideas are even something you didn't even imagine for your own recipe. It's kind of cool.
Oh, right. I mean, just like people live in different parts of the country and they just have different family backgrounds. And it's just like cool variations that just become their own things. And I mean, that's how I use cookbooks, really, honestly. You've seen my cookbook library, always needing to be filed. And I've seen yours. So we both have a lot. And it's just like a lot of inspiration, pulling things down into huge piles and then needing to stack them back up.
So I have a question for both Amy and Ted here, because you guys are professionals. I sort of take some pride in my cookbooks when I open it up and a little bit of wild rice falls out from the last time I cooked in it, or you can kind of see the butter stains.
Oh.
What are your cookbooks like? Do you keep them pristine?
Like ones I use?
Yeah.
I don't know. I mean, probably don't follow. I'm just using it to inspire.
Okay.
Sometimes I do, though. Like a couple weeks ago, I made something out of the Pock Pock book. God, that's a good book. I mean, I don't know how to make Thai food, really, so I needed it. How about you, Ted? What do we have in your pages?
Well, that's a badge of honor to have a grain of rice fall out of the cookbook. That's amazing. I would love that. But I often do find that, like, I'll have like a messy piece of herb or something fall out of a cookbook. I think the more you use your cookbooks, the more you get them greasy, the more they're lived in. A lot of the times, if for cookbooks I really love, I'll have like a desk copy and a kitchen copy.
Ooh.
You ever do that, Amy?
Like, no.
Have two copies, one for like treasuring and one for just like ripping through, you know?
I don't, but I have two copies of your book right now because I always give them away to people because I want them to have your book.
Thank you.
But I'm just thinking like, yeah.
Such a great show. I just loved what Natasha was saying. So much insight. That thing about that the kitchen scale that some people see as a burden could actually be the source of pleasure. You know, like that could be the thing that made, you know, cooking more pleasurable. And I loved what Nick was saying about being the ADHD test kitchen guy.
Yeah, totally. Hey, Ted, we need your recommendations for... Oops, sorry. We need your recommendations for scales, if you don't mind, for the newsletter. Can you send those to me?
Oh, I'm trying to think which one I have. I think I have the, you know, the cheapest one, the $30 one.
Great.
It might even be $25.
I think this is going to...
I just make sure I keep a good supply of those coin batteries.
Yeah.
I think this is going to change my life, thanks to you guys. So I appreciate it.
Thank you, Ted. Thanks for calling.
Thank you.
We do have another caller joining us.
Hey, you're on Ham Radio.
Hi.
Hello.
I was just listening briefly. I just joined in the last 5 or 10 minutes. But
that's okay.
What you're talking about reminded me of a cookbook that I had actually won in a raffle, The Joy of Cooking. And it's interesting the way that cookbook is written. It gives you the recipe, but then it also tells you, oh, but you can do this, you can add this, or you can add that. And it gives you so many variations. So it kind of like encourages you to make all the recipes in the cookbook your own recipe. So...
Yeah, it's kind of like choose your own adventure.
Reminded me of that.
That's, you know, it's true. It's like it's giving you these like permission and suggestions for inventing. So what are some of your favorite recipes from that book?
Well, I guess the one that, I mean, it was just so so simple is the Alfredo one.
Yeah.
Because I did not know how simple was, like, it has like 3 ingredients, and then, you know, what you can do to, you know, add to it and change it and all of that. So
do you add something to that? So it's like cream, it's like pasta, cream, and butter, right?
Yeah, cream, butter, and Parmesan cheese.
Oh, yeah, Parmesan cheese.
Right, and then I do all kinds of things to it and add, of course, garlic and, I don't know, I'll saute different things in a separate pan. And I mean, I just kind of learned that on my own, that if I'm going to add things to it, I don't want to mess up the exact ingredients that are in there because it might change the consistency of the sauce. So I kind of... Like, so, you know, I'll saute things in a separate pan and then add it to it at, kind of at the last minute. And, yeah, I mean, I just can't believe, I mean, it's terrible for you, but I mean,
What does that mean? What are you talking about? Nothing's terrible for you.
Tons of butter, tons of, you know, cream, full-fat cream, tons of, you know, Parmesan cheese.
Well,
And then, of course, you know, noodles.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I don't know. Once in a while, I think it's just fine.
Well,
but,
thank you so much for calling.
We agree.
We're out of time. Where are you calling from?
Bemidji.
All right. Thanks for joining us. We also got a text coming in. My great-grandma Martha's Monster Cookies were a staple at all family get-togethers. Some are better at replicating hers than others. First time my mom made them, she tried to use butter, not margarine, and they were just not the same. You need to use the Blue Bonnet margarine in order for it to stay the same, which, yeah, that makes some sense.
No, it does. It really does. Yeah.
Recipes, we want them. We want you to tell us more. Keep your stories coming. You can text us
at 218-326-1234.
This has been Ham Radio.
Doesn't matter where I go. Another day, another show. Nowhere else feels like home.
Hey, Slam Radio is produced at the KBXE Studios in Bemidji and made possible by the Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund of Minnesota. Hosts and creators Amy Thielen, produced by Heidi Holton. You Know How I Like It is a licensed original song from Jeremy Messersmith. Original Ham Radio artwork by T.L. Celine and graphic design by Christopher Larson. Thanks to KAXE's Chelsea Perkins and photographer Lori Scholl. Find more Ham Radio at KAXE.com.